I think that I will first need to convince you that the subject is, if not interesting, then at least controversial within the biological community, and then talk about real issues. So my plan is the following. I will give the most basic definitions and concepts, then we'll consider three possibilities, which are actually here. Then we'll talk a little bit about technical problems which appear in the model of synthetic fixation. Then we'll talk about results, some results of this modeling. Then we'll talk about two other scenarios which I claim do not work. There are three scenarios and I believe one of them does work and two of them don't. And then finally we'll talk about the data, which are not very abundant in this field. So in biology there is a lot of talking about species concepts, and I'm not going to go into this at all because it's historically one of the most controversial, complicated, and I would say useless subjects. For the purpose of today's consideration, it's absolutely sufficient to think of a species, of different species, as sets of substantially different organisms. So crows is one species, and I don't know, blackbirds is another species. Species is singular and plural coincide. And speciation is the origin of species. We'll be particularly interested in what biologists who like fancy Greek and Latin words called cladogenesis, when one lineage splits into two. So clade means a branch, so you get new branches. And this process was discovered and its mechanisms were first discussed by Charles Darwin in 1859, because evolutionary model which existed before Darwin, that of Lamarck, did not assume any cladogenesis. Lamarck accepted evolution, but he thought that every lineage evolves independently. He did not believe in common ancestry of different forms. So according to Lamarck, evolution was like this, but there were no branching points. So Darwin was the first one to think about common ancestry of different species, and therefore about cladogenesis. So I will talk about speciation in this narrow sense of the process which increases the number of species. And then there are two obvious possibilities for this cladogenetic speciation, which again, in a very fancy biological language, are called allopatric and sympatric. Allos means different, sim means the same, and patria means where you live. So allopatric means speciation which proceeds after geographic isolation. You have two populations, we have one population which first splits into two by some external barrier, and then these two populations are leading their independent lives on east coast and west coast, or a more striking example in the Pacific and in the Caribbean after the Isthmus of Panama was formed, or whatever. They lead their independent lives and they don't know and they couldn't care less that together they're engaged in the process of allopatric speciation. Then five million years later, somebody comes to the Isthmus of Panama and brings together similar crayfish from Caribbean and the Pacific, and studies if they regard each other as potential sexual partners or as food. And usually they regard each other as food, and this is called the completion of allopatric fixation. So this process is, as long as you accept evolution, this process is almost unavoidable, because if two things evolve independently, sooner or later they're bound to become, well, as different as possible. The space of possibilities is so huge that independent evolution will lead you to different corners of this enormous space. So I'm not going to talk about allopatric fixation because it is theoretically trivial. And on the other hand, sympatric fixation is a very controversial process. I must say from the very beginning that I'm going to talk only about sexual individuals. In case of about, let's think for simplicity about obligatory sexual reproduction. Because if you consider purely asexual forms, which do exist even among multicellular animals, in this case there is no real difference between allopatry and sympatry, because even two sibs immediately after they were produced by the same asexual mother, they are genetically isolated from each other. So in some sense, in the case of complete asexuality, an interesting question is why we still have some coherent species, which we do have. Because every individual forms an independent lineage, and you can have some kind of, I don't know, exponential instability, everybody going in its own direction. So speciation without sex is not a problem, but it was understood, I think Darwin already made it clear, that this clade genesis, this increase of diversity and divergence, certainly is opposed by sexual reproduction. Two things within the same population start diverging, you, I don't know, get very big things and very small things, then they interbreed and produce the whole spectrum of intermediates, and how could they work? So that's the main issue, sympatric speciation under sexual reproduction. Now I need to talk...
Let me understand your position. Mm-hmm. Your position is the following, that that if you don't have sex, there is speciation, and there is no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if you have sex, the sex tends to act as a bringing together mechanism, and then you have to see how, in the presence of sex, you can avoid having speciation, and when...
No, how you can avoid... How can you have
sex?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
So in fact, you are going to explain to us why there is not so much speciation.
No. Exactly the opposite. If we have sexual reproduction, it works to make population cohesive. You cannot have, if you mix white people and black people, and even under severe racism, and forget about, and with even under severe racism, they will interbreed. And even in the most racist society, if you keep people together for 1,000 generations, there will be one mixed population. Some of them will think they're whites, and some of them think they're blacks, but they will really all be all shades of gray. So that's sexual interbreeding. So the problem is that if everybody mates with everybody, then it's very difficult for a population to split. Well, it's impossible for a population to split. So that's why allopatric speciation is simple and uncontroversial, even regardless of sex. You have two different populations. Within each population, you have sexual reproduction. So you don't need one cohesive population to split. It's two populations which go different ways. That's not a problem. But the problem is how a sexual population can split. Is it clear, or should I? Okay. So now I want to go a little bit into the recent history of evolutionary biology, because some of you might hear, well, some fragments of this picture. So Darwin's book was called Speciation by the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. And then in the middle of the 20th century, it was a very interesting movement in this country, which was called modern synthesis. And, well, if anything, synthesis was between Darwinian natural selection and Mendelian discrete genes. For a while, there were very interesting fights before several people, the most prominent of them, Sir Ronald Fisher, recognized that it is, well, these are two sides of the same coin, in the sense that for Darwinian evolution, you need both discrete hereditary factors and natural selection. So if we're talking about synthesis of Mendelian genetics and Darwinian natural selection, that's fine. But unfortunately, this word, this expression modern synthesis, acquired a lot of different connotations. Everybody uses it in his or her own way. And in particular, in this country, for reasons, well, some historical reasons, it became common to think of modern synthesis as an idea that speciation is not going according to the Darwin. So Darwin, the story, which is just patently false, but became very popular among American evolutionary biologists, the story is that Darwin didn't understand the origin of species. And I'm not kidding. You can read it in textbooks. And that Darwinian model of speciation by natural selection is wrong. That, in fact, speciation goes against natural selection. And this led to the whole bunch of absolutely loony theories called genetic revolutions, peak shifts, founder flash speciation, well, whatever. This is a very funny story, because everybody who bothers to read the fourth chapter of The Origin of Species will find, yeah, and part of this modern synthesis is that sympatric speciation is a dirty word. It never happens. This is stupid. Ernst Mayr told us it's impossible. And this is all very funny. Well, Darwin is not Holy Bible. He might be wrong. But at least if you read the fourth chapter of The Origin of Species, you will see that, A, Darwin at least gave some thoughts about the origin of species. B, he considered sympatric speciation to be the main mode of speciation, the basic mode of speciation. And C, he believed that sympatric speciation goes by means of natural selection, which follows from the title of his book. All this was completely ignored. Again, I don't mind. If people say Darwin was stupid, he said this and this, but this is wrong, this would be fine. The common view, which you can take the latest textbook on evolution by my dear friend Doug Futuma and find all these lies in this textbook. So the model which became popular, well, around 1940, is this. You have a fitness surface. This was my love's attempt to draw a fitness surface, well, which is just a generic function from Rn into one variable, which is called fitness. Since I cannot draw more than 2 for my Rn, this is my generic surface with some isolated peaks, and each species occupies a peak, and some peaks are presumably empty, and speciation consists of a jump from one peak to another. Well, in quantum mechanics, you may like, it may sound reasonable for you, tunneling and all these nice jumps, but you cannot tunnel a chimp into a human, because all these intermediate steps, they must kind of exist. These are not virtual particles, this is something real. And the idea for this tunneling was this. You need a very small population. And then in this very small population, natural selection cannot prevent speciation. So, you know, so natural selection always moves you up the gradient of fitness function. So for the most basic selection equations, fitness is a Lyapunov function. You always go, it it always increases along the trajectories of your dynamical systems. So when you start your speciation, you need to go downhill in terms of fitness. And this can be done if natural selection for a moment forgets about its duties, and then you go over this fitness valley, so it's low, and then you are in the basin of attraction of another fitness peak, and then you are fine. Then natural selection suddenly begins working again and moves you to another fitness peak. Until very recently, I think for the last 5 years, it became obvious that this, at least, at the very least, this is not a refined model of speciation by Darwin. This is a patently anti-Darwinian model, and what is even worse, it probably never happens in nature. So I'm not going to talk about this. All my business is very strictly Darwinian. I don't want to sound dogmatic, but this is Darwinism in its most extreme form. So I'm going to talk about speciation by means of natural selection. It's another interesting subject, why this counter-adaptive speciation apparently doesn't happen. Just a very brief thing, which we will revisit later, that's something which I'm working on now. That's an alternative model, which for some reason, alternative to this jumping, tunneling from peak to peak. This model of curved ridges of high fitness was proposed more or less at the same time. This is a model of, I would call it, Wright-Meyer, and this is model of Dobzhansky-Müller. For reasons which I cannot comprehend, there was no connection between these two models. People discussed them more or less simultaneously. Nobody drew a picture like this on the same page. You're the first people to witness this great event. Now, this is really strange, you know. Talking in front of physicists, I feel humbled, because I think that as a group, as a biological theorist, we're just incredibly stupid, because the progress which, well, maybe I'm overestimating physicists when you don't know somebody, you think that they're smart and they're not. But the progress which for a smart guy should take, I don't know, 3 weeks, it takes decades. So that's a model of Dobzhansky-Müller.
Did anybody consider the possibility of time-dependent environment in which you start with one peak?
Of course. Well, yeah, Charles Darwin did it. And we will move to this. That was my last attempt. Of course. That's a very good point, of course. So if you have an invariant fitness surface, indeed any generic surface has discrete maxima, and you have to do this jumping. But there is no reason why this surface should be... Yes?
Sorry, just to clarify this other picture, maybe it's putting words in your mouth, but is it that somehow in this high-dimensional space there might be occasional sort of flat directions, or nearly flat directions that can take you...
Yes.
And then it's not so much that they're separate...
Well, they're not... Well, give me a second. We don't need the thing to be exactly flat. So this may really be a trajectory of some peak when this surface changes with time due to some external influences. So let me.
But it's potentially a misleading thing to think about two dimensions, because it does have that special character.
I think two dimensions is enough. Well, we have the third dimension fitness here, going here, right?
Okay.
I think that two dimensions... So what Dobzhansky and Müller said was this. We start from here. Let's call the things a small, b small. And so this direction is associated with gene A, and this direction is associated with gene B. So then one population evolves from A small to A large, another evolves from B small to B large, and both replacements were adaptive. But now let's assume that A large and B large are incompatible. So if these two things interbreed, they will produce a heterozygote A large, A small, B large, B small, and for some reason this is this thing is bad. So we had speciation without going through any fitness valley. And we don't need the thing to be flat, it's just a trajectory of some peaks. So we started here, and in one place we went there, and another place we went there. And this was expressed in these genetical terms, but we are really talking about a curved ridge of more or less high fitness in this multidimensional space of genetics.
Well, of course, there is still the difficulty that there is no continuing way to go from A, B, B, from small to big, small, without actually having the...
No, you go this way. If you want to come from here, you first replace B large with B small, and then you replace it, you can do it this way. Dobzhansky-Miller thought about going from here and then doing this way and that way, but you can do whatever you want.
So, is discretization due to discrete mechanism of genetics itself?
Well, yes. Genetics doesn't allow you to occupy very well. Yes.
You give some discrete rules, and you have to obey them.
Yes.
What we really ask you is, in the genetic space, there are no continuum lines. You either have a big A or a small A. So we don't really understand what is a continuum line in that space.
Well, now I understand. Well, that's certainly true that this space is discrete, but it can be pretty fine. Because selection really acts on phenotypes, and there are genes with major effects. So you cannot be, 50% pregnant, and this is not a gene, but there could be only major phenotypes. You are either a healthy individual, or you are a chondroplastic dwarf, which is that small, and there are no intermediates. But a chondroplasia, yeah.
Well,
well, yes, there is a thing which is called achondroplasia. There are very many other situations when, for reasons which we absolutely don't understand, this space of possible phenotypes is kind of covered by genotypes in a very fine way. So you can go very gradually, which we know from paleontology, the classical work on evolution of whatever. If you have good enough paleontological record, you see very small continuous changes. So I would not put... That's a good point, but it's not a matter of doing this in one jump. We can have, 100 loci which gradually move you in this direction. Let's assume that this is size and this is color. So you start being small and white, and this way you go gradually increase your size, you become large and white, and this way you gradually become black. And then let's assume that if you're very large and very black, then these intermediate things will be unhappy.
Would you think that, when you talk about multilocus models, so in the same degree as you enhance the number of loci, possibly the assumption that the hybrids have all lower fitness, which is a prerequisite, is more and more difficult?
Well, probably not, because it seems that this difficulty of hybrids, which can be either just lethality or sterility, this is because of some individual pairs, incompatible pairs of genes. And now there is a very interesting line of experimental work. There is a guy in Chicago named Chen Yiwu who tries to map this incompatibility between allopatric species. I am totally digressing from the line of what I wanted to talk about, but you can take allopatric Drosophila from the West Coast and the East Coast and breed them, and for example, females are more or less okay, but males are sterile. Then you can map the genes which are, we used to talk about regions of chromosomes, now we can be down almost to individual genes, and I think that within several years we will see which exactly are these molecular interactions which don't work between different species. So the more differences you have, the more genetic differences you have between these two species, the more is the probability that at least one interaction will be incompatible. You will have one situation like this. Well, some A large and some B large. And this led to a very simple result, well, very simple understanding, that when you have this allopatric speciation process, so you made this Isthmus of Panama. And then suppose that you come every 10,000 years and see if two sister species of shrimp from Pacific and from the Caribbean can interbreed. And the very simple realization was that we expect this probability to behave more or less like this. If this is time, and this is probability of interbreeding, we start from 1, and then it will go down something like this. It will be not exactly a phase transition, but a rapid thing, because this number of potential incompatible combinations grew quadratically with time. Yes?
With reference to that, I think the point that, you know, some of the aspects of the genotype, phenotype are going to be more continuous, and so maybe height is indeed more continuous, but the number of digits on your hand, on human hand, doesn't follow Poisson distribution.
Well, sure, but this is not genotype, yeah. Well,
it is too.
Yeah.
So you say that the effect might be caused by sort of the first real incompatibility?
Yes. Yes. This is apparently just true. You can find an individual pair of genes which is responsible for sterility of hybrids between something and something. Okay. So my only point, really, which I wanted to make, is that the fact that we have discrete species, because the logic of Meyer was very simple. You breed cats and dogs, or humans and pigs, and the hybrids are unhappy. Then the implication was that in the process of speciation of humans and pigs from the common ancestor, you had to go through a fitness valley, which is just not true if you move into two dimensions. It doesn't require more than two dimensions. So the fact that we have discrete species with hybrids unhappy absolutely do not imply that speciation has to go through any counteradaptive moments. And now we're back to Darwin. So that's Darwin's model of sympatric speciation. Darwin thought of, I am rephrasing him I even have a quotation from Darwin. I am restating him in modern vocabulary, but I really don't have very much to add to what he said. The more diversified the descendants from any one species become in structure, constitution, and habits, by so much will they be better enabled to seize on many and widely diversified places in the polity of nature, and so be enabled to increase in numbers. The competition will generally be most severe between those forms which are most nearly related to each other in habits, constitution, and structure. Hence, all the intermediate forms, as well as the original parent species itself, will generally tend to become extinct. So the idea is this. Suppose that we start in the center. That's some phenotypes. Let's think of just one phenotypic trait, size. The green is the distribution of the trait in the population. And these two red things are ecological resources. There is one resource which you can utilize better when you are small, and another resource which you can utilize better when you are large. Think of a predator which can eat either water fleas or fish. Predator fish. Then, when population is in the center, the extremes are in a better shape, because these things outcompete everybody for eating fish, and these small things outcompete everybody when it comes to eating water fleas. However, if you are in this low end of the spectrum, if we have a population where essentially everybody is small, then I have a lot of fish which is underutilized. So this resource which is good for big organisms is underutilized. So selection is this black line. Selection favors big things. And if everybody is eating fish, there are a lot of water fleas, so selection favors those who are small. So you have diverse resources, and then natural selection favors diversity, but when this diversity is achieved, natural selection favors the extremes. This is frequency-dependent disruptive selection, which was verbally described by Darwin. Very interesting results were recently obtained by a guy named Michael Debly, who now is in Vancouver. He's originally from Switzerland, now he's in Vancouver, I believe. He showed that even if the distribution of this ecological resources is unimodal, but kind of wide, even in this case, this may lead to disruptive selection. You don't really need too extreme resources, because even if you have unimodal distribution of resource, those who are in the center compete like crazy. Remember what Darwin was saying about this, and it can lead to disruptive selection. But if you have two discrete resources, then this frequency-dependent disruptive selection appears almost inevitable. So this was the Darwin's idea of speciation by competitive natural selection, disruptive frequency-dependent selection due to competition, and of course this is a model of sympatric speciation. If different things live allopatrically, well, they cannot compete with each other. Okay. And now I will talk about various complications of this scenario. Yes, so allopatric speciation, we already discussed it. Yeah, and now back to this issue of sex. How can you suppose that this Darwinian mechanism really works? So this frequency dependence pushes the population in the center, and in the center you want to be the very small or very large, but still the small things and large things will keep interbreeding and will keep producing maladapted intermediates. So what to do? Here there was one big difference between Darwin and the co-discoverer of natural selection, Alfred Wallace, and in this case I believe that Wallace was right, because Wallace said, okay, up to this point Darwin's model is correct, but now you can understand that natural selection under these circumstances would favor reproductive isolation. If you are large, you don't want to mate with a small, because your kids will be intermediate and they will be in trouble. So Wallace thought that after this situation is established, natural selection will actively seek reproductive isolation between these two extremes.
This is exactly opposite to what you answered me in the beginning. Here we have the sex, in fact, acting as a species, poor speciation.
No. if we don't have any sex, then there would be no problem. This reproductive isolation just mitigates this anti-speciation action of sex, because if they keep interbreeding, forget about speciation. The best thing would be for them just to become asexual. But if they, for some reason, don't want to do this, then the next best thing, you can have your sex okay, but have sex only with those who are similar to you. So, yes, so for, yeah, I made this cryptic statement about disequilibria. Let me write it down, because there is a peculiar vocabulary in population genetics. It's probably, if you have a competition for the single worst term in all natural sciences, the linkage disequilibrium will be a winner, because it has nothing to do with linkage and nothing to do with equilibrium. So I will use this chemical notation. So this thing is a frequency of allele A. So if I have haploid situation, so at every locus, an individual has only one allele. So we have two haploid loci. So the possible genotypes are A large, B large, A large, B small, A small, B large, and A small, B small. Then in order to describe statistical dependence of distribution of alleles at locus A and B, so we have allele A with loci, we have locus A with alleles A large and A small, and locus B with alleles B large and B small. And a reasonable way to describe how these things are distributed, to what extent they are distributed non-independently, is this. So obviously, in case of independence, the frequency of a genotype, for example, frequency of A large, B large, is just the product of frequencies of alleles which constitute the genotype. And then this linkage disequilibrium must be zero. But if the frequency of a genotype is not equal to the product of frequencies of alleles which constitute the genotype, then this thing may be non-zero, it can be positive if capital letters and small letters tend to be together, or it can be negative if capital letters tend to be with small letters. But it's non-zero, and this coefficient is called linkage disequilibrium, which is very bad word. Why it's a useful thing, if we have, that's a theorem which is actually very easy to prove, if we have sex with random mate and free recombination, then in the next moment of time, linkage disequilibrium is 2 times less than in the previous moment of time. Sexual reproduction reduces these statistical associations between alleles at different loci by 50% every generation. Random mating is random mating, and free recombination is a reasonable assumption because genes which are on different chromosomes almost always recombine freely, and if you take a pair of genes, the chances are they will be on different chromosomes. So this, free recombination is a reasonable assumption.
I make a plea that recombination used in this sense is potentially misleading because there is a different recombination, and the word reassortment is often used where you're using recombination. That is, you reassort the chromosomes.
I am following Kuroo Kimura. Standard notation,
There's a difference, for instance, in regular genetics, not population genetics. Mm-hmm. Linkage disequilibrium means genes on the same chromosome, but you tend not to have recombination.
Linkage disequilibrium is a bad term. I'm not defending it.
Recombination can have two meanings when you ask it to also mean reassortment. And therefore, it's better just to say reassortment.
Well, no, it's not better because recombination can be due to random assortment, independent assortment of genes on different chromosomes, and because of recombination within the chromosome. But again, in population genetics, it's both called recombination, and I just cannot switch it because I will go nuts immediately if I try. Well, nobody cares about the species. It's all about individual selection. If I am a big organism, I don't want my kids to suffer, and that's the whole story. What is good for the species, I don't know, and Dr. Darwin doesn't know and doesn't care.
What I'm saying is that this kernel of two very unfit guys can be a very fit guy with this model. And therefore it might be that for quite a long while that intermediate guy would kind of make it.
Well, okay. Okay, well, we will come back to this a little. So, all the disequilibria are reduced by 50% each generation if we have random mating and free recombination. I explained this cryptic statement. And now we inevitably come to this universal two-step scenario. First of all, we need a pair of reproductively isolated genotypes. For example, we now need to assume that these very small things and very big things do not interbreed, because otherwise you can have this situation with disruptive selection forever, but you will never have two species. So you need a pair of reproductively isolated genotypes. This cryptic word true breeding means that these genotypes are homozygous. So when they have these big things, they will never produce small things by mating within themselves. Human interbreedings with other humans never produce chimps. So we have a pair of reproductively isolated genotypes. We need them within the range of genetic variability within our population. And then all intermediate genotypes which carry a mixture of genes from one extreme and another reproductively isolated extreme, all intermediate genotypes must be somehow eliminated. So that's how sympatric speciation, if it happens, that's how it's going to happen. And then there are three scenarios. What time is it, and what under what time constraints am I operating?
10:45.
So
as usual, we have our break sometime between 11 and 1, whenever you find a good
time. And then there will be another.
And then.
Okay.
Yeah. Have another hour.
Okay. Very good. Then I'm in good shape. Thank you. So, for this sequence of events to happen, there are three options, really. One, which I believe is the only real one of the three, is Darwin-Wallace. We already discussed it. This frequency-dependent disruptive selection followed by secondary selection for reproductive isolation. In order to analyze the selection for reproductive isolation properly, you need to assume that you have another locus and with, say, two alleles or quantitative trait whose only impact is that if you possess this trait, then you do not meet with the opposite extreme. And then see if there is any significant selection which will promote such a trait. So this Darwin Wallace option. Then there was an extremely interesting idea which implicitly belongs to Fisher, although Fisher never considered this idea as applied to speciation. The idea is that Mendelian segregation per se can do the job under reproductive isolation. Let's return to this later. And finally, there is a new idea which is now very popular. It was never exploited. It was never explored properly as far as theory is concerned, at least that's my opinion, but it's very sexy because it involves sexual selection. So the motivation is this. You know, great African lakes, Lake Victoria, Lake Malawi, several other lakes, and in each lake you can find a species flock of cichlids. In Lake Malawi, nobody knows how many cichlids are there, but over 1,000, that's for sure, which are doing all kinds of things, which obviously originated within this lake. And what is nice about the cichlids, they're very colorful. You have species which are otherwise very similar, but in one species, males are deep blue, and another species, they're deep red, literally of colors like this. So females, when they mate with conspecific males, must be looking at their color, and this is called sexual selection, allegedly. So the model is this. Suppose that you have a trait which now has nothing to do with your ecology. We're not talking about being big and feeding on fish, or being small and feeding on water fleas. We're talking about female preference. If you are you have this, I don't know how to call it, if you have this red preference, if you have a small value of this trait, you like red males. If you have a big value of this trait, you like green males. And that's a situation. And the idea is that this kind of a divergent sexual selection can lead to instability, and population can split into two. So red preferring females will be paired with red males, and as a result of this you will get a red species, and green preferring females will pair with green males, and you will get a green preferred green species, and those in between would be in deep trouble because nobody wants to mate with them, so you will get two discrete species. This is a recent idea which probably should be attributed to 1995 paper by Turner and Boros, sympatric speciation due to sexual selection. So I am going to spend most of the time talking about this.
Yeah? I have two questions about this thing. First of all, then you are left with explaining why the females would have such a crazy behavior. Second, there would be a natural hypothesis which should be eliminated in order to take this seriously. That in fact, because of the variation in the legs, two populations which became incompatible, but they are still physically similar, they could get came together, and then they had to develop some signal.
Well, they're usually okay. Let's talk about this later, since I'm going to argue that this scenario is not working. I cannot defend it really well. You need somebody else to defend the scenario.
I know Philip Rusfernoff has studied some of these fish, and what he said is that the lake is becoming muddy, and so the species are breaking down.
Yeah. This is probably true. They indeed use color as an important clue with whom to mate, and when water becomes muddy, species barriers break down because they're not reproductively isolated from each other. This is probably true. This absolutely does not imply that sexual selection was involved in the process of speciation. So let's talk about this later. Yeah.
So what were the colors for in the first place?
Let's return to this later. I don't want to talk about this lousy scenario anymore. I don't believe in it.
There's one thing about it. There seems to be, if the preference is for your own color, then why aren't the middle colorings...
It's not a preference for your own color. These females are pretty grayish. They don't care. It's a female preference. A female who prefers red may be as gray as a female who prefers blue. But she knows what she wants. It's really two-trait situation. It's a female preference, male color. That's another interesting issue. There are several different kinds of phenotype architecture here, and very often within the context of speciation, for some reason, people consider this similar made similar. So blue, and this may be true. Big things made big things, and small things made small things. But now we're talking about two-trait system. It's female preference, male signal, and they may be genetically, these may be two genetically independent traits.
As you said, you're not going to defend this at all, but the sexual selection always seems to me that it can explain anything.
Can or cannot?
You can. I mean, you have some species with three horns, you can say that.
Well, there is one exception. I argue sexual selection cannot explain sympatric speciation.
Okay.
Maybe everything else. Okay. So, now, in order to show how smart I am, I will talk about technical problems with the modeling for a little while. And again, this is funny, because all this path which I am going to go over, again, for a good theoretical physicist, it should probably take, I don't know, maybe I'm saying 3 weeks, maybe it's too long. For a good physicist, it should be 3 hours. For me, it took 20 years. And I would never tell you such embarrassing stories if I were the only idiot, but everybody else who worked in this field are equally stupid, so I feel less embarrassed because of this. So the problem is, how do you technically model this multi-locus situation? Let's assume that I want just one trait. I want to consider things being small and things being big. I'm sorry, let me do it this way. I think I need a strong motivation for why we need to consider this multi-locus case. And this is relevant to what somebody said about discreteness imposed by genetics, and also relevant to Fisher's scenario. So let me first, let me first go to this Fisher's scenario, which will explain why I believe we absolutely need to consider multi-locus situations. So suppose that we have just one locus. One locus with two alleles, and now I assume that individuals are diploid. I will switch from diploid to haploid and back very liberally, and you have to believe me that it doesn't make a big difference. So a lot of models are easier to consider in the haploid case, but they can be generalized and a little bit made a little bit more complex and accommodate the diploid case. If we have a haploid situation, we have one haploid locus, then we have organisms of only two types, A large and A small. We need a pair of genotypes which do not interbreed, and we have the only pair available here, so our assumption means that we already have two species. So this is no cool. Let's consider this. And in order for speciation to be feasible within this model, we need to assume that this mating is impossible. A large doesn't mate with A small, A small. Which is a crazy assumption biologically, but it happens sometimes. The most crazy example are snails, which can have right-hand coilins and left-hand coilins, which is one Mendelian gene. So when two things like this try to copulate, they are in deep trouble. They don't know how to do it, and sometimes they die, sometimes they eat each other in frustration, so it's very sad. So this is feasible. If this happens, then, and this is the Fisher's argument, the intermediates will disappear without any selection against them. For a very simple reason. Let's consider all possible. Okay, you are physicists, you are smart, I don't need to write it as I do it in, as I did it in introductory evolution. Let's consider all possible matings. In matings within this, all parents are homozygotes, all offspring are homozygotes. The same here. In mating between homozygote and heterozygote, it's 50-50. So 50% of parents are heterozygotes, 50% of offspring are heterozygotes. And when heterozygotes mate within themselves, both parents are heterozygous, but only 50% of offspring are heterozygous. So this mating of A large, A small, A large, A small decreases the fraction of heterozygotes. So decreasing. And the only opposite process is the mating between two opposite homozygotes. That's the only mating in which the fraction of heterozygotes among the offspring is larger than the fraction of heterozygotes among the parents. So if we prohibit this mating, heterozygotes disappear just due to Mendelian segregation without anything. And you don't need any disruptive or whatever selection. Reproductive isolation leads to elimination of intermediates just on its own. And because of this, single locus models are not representative to the general case. So we still can consider these snails, but admittedly that's a crazy situation biologically. That's a rare exception. Usually if you don't want to marry somebody, that's not due to one gene, that's due to combination of many genes and many other factors.
There is, however, the following situation. Suppose you have an environment in which big A and small a, they are both of them quite favored, but the relative favoredness of them varies in time. Then it would be advantageous for each of them to cheat this link with the other guy, such that in conditions in which he would be disadvantaged, the gene big A, suppose big A is disadvantaged for a while.
I'm not talking about any selection here. Let's assume everything is neutral. There is no advantages or disadvantages. My only point is that a situation when two organisms refuse to interbreed because of difference at a single locus, this is a very rare situation. Again, this can be some pathological thing. But within normal genetic variability, I can think of very few examples. So And then the only reason for considering single locus models would be, okay, this model does not imitate reality usually, but it's a good approximation for a general multi-locus situation. And I am arguing that it's not a good approximation, because in this single locus case, reproductive isolation per se leads to extinction of intermediates. If we consider two loci and say that we forbid this mating between these two opposite extremes, nothing really happens. Well, there will be a little bit more extremes at equilibrium, but there will be nothing like elimination of intermediates. So the case of single locus is exceptional, and the four, because it's exceptional in its dynamical properties, and because it's also very rare and crazy biologically, we must consider multi-locus models. That's that's a point which I wanted to make before talking about difficulties.
In a multi-locus model, it was just one of those which was forbidden to breed between the two enzymes. So you have suppose you have many loci.
Okay.
One of those loci is doing what the A locus can do.
Well, then I can say that I have only one locus. Let's ignore all other loci.
Doesn't that lead to some sort of segregation between the B locus as well?
Well, let's write it down on paper, but my point is that any complete isolation due to single locus is not a common situation. So this multi-locus theory. So now we have n loci. We assume that these are the simplest assumptions, these loci are all equal. So the phenotype, and yes, each locus has alleles 0 or 1. And since these loci are equal, they contribute equally to some phenotype. So the phenotype is simply the total number of alleles 1 at your genotype. So we have genotypes and phenotypes, which are classes of genotypes, really. And now let's consider haploids for a while. So how do we go by analyzing this model? What can we do? Well, we can consider n allele frequencies, which at the phenotypic level is equivalent to considering only the mean distribution of a phenotype. Okay, I should probably state the biggest problem right here. The problem is two up to the n's. So if we have haploids, we have two up to the n's possible genotypes. And if we have diploids, we have three up to the n's. With diploidy, we assume that we don't discriminate between 0, 1, and 1, 0. So which allele of your two alleles at the locus is maternal and which is paternal doesn't matter. So we have very, very many variables. What do we do? If we consider allele frequencies only, that's obviously insufficient, because you can have everybody in the middle, everybody middle size, or you can have half large and half small. In both cases, all allele frequencies are 50%, so that's not enough. We can consider frequencies and covariances, that's also not enough. Because this assumes that the phenotypic distribution is Gaussian. You can have different variances, but you still are within the Gaussian distribution assumption. And this is a standard way of doing genetics of quantitative traits, but unfortunately, it's absolutely not applicable to modeling speciation, because in the course of speciation, unimodal distribution must become bimodal. So you cannot have this assumption. Then you can have an honest model. Honest model of 2 up to the n, formally speaking, 2 up to the n's minus 1, because the sum of these frequencies is 1. But this doesn't help very much if n is large. So if you honestly model all possible genotypes, the model becomes completely useless, starting from n, I don't know, equal to 5 or something. And the right-hand sides are pretty horrifying. You have essentially all pairs, and then you need the Mendelian segregation operator there. So you can still study these equations numerically, well, up to n equal, I don't know, 10 maybe. But it's not very good. And then this is the answer, but it took a very long time to understand that this is really an answer and how this answer can be used. Let's consider a general phenotypic model. So we will have only two n plus one different variables. Each two n of them are independent. So we have our phenotypic classes. So the phenotypic model means that our dynamical variable is a frequency of a phenotype, which is a combined frequency of all genotypes having a particular number of alleles 1. So this is certainly much better. Having two n plus 1 variables is way better than having two up to the nth variables. But the question is, can this phenotypic model be dynamically sufficient? For selection, yes. We assume that selection looks at your phenotype. So in order to know how your frequency will be altered by selection, it's enough to know your phenotype. But the question is about reproduction. Well, you can obviously immediately see that this is not true. I'm sorry. The idea is good, but the example is bad. So, yeah, now the individuals are vertical vectors. So we have two matings. In both cases, we have phenotype 1. But in one case, we had 0, 1, mating with 1, 0. In another case, we have 0, 1, mating with 0, 1. In terms of phenotypes, these are two identical matings, both matings between individuals of phenotype 1. But in this case, you can get only offspring of phenotype 1 because the offspring will get 1 at this first locus, it has no other option, and it will get 0 at the other locus, it has no other option. And here you can have anything. You can have, well, 1, 0, 0, 1, or 0, 0, 1, 1. So you will have the variability among the offspring of this mating, but not among the offspring of that mating. So you can immediately see that knowing phenotypes of the parents is not sufficient to predicting phenotypes, to say nothing about genotypes. We don't need genotypes, but in order to get a closed system of equations, it's necessary that knowing phenotypes of parents is enough to predict phenotypes of the offspring. And we can immediately see that this is not true. So how can we use phenotypic models in this case? And fortunately, there are two situations, one not very useful and another extremely useful, when phenotypical models become dynamically sufficient. And let's take a break and then talk about it. Okay, so how can we use this phenotypical approach to modeling if we can very easily see that knowing phenotypes of parents is not sufficient to know the phenotype distribution in the offspring? There are two situations when this is not true and phenotypic approach can be used. One is if we consider the very end of speciation process. So let's assume that the process is already almost finished. That's my distribution of phenotypes of the number of alleles 1 and my number of alleles 1, the phenotype, and that's a distribution. Almost everybody belongs to either one forming species or another species, forming species, so it really tends to infinity here, and we have only very few intermediates left. It can be haploid models, and the maximal phenotype is N, alleles 1, or a diploid model, the maximal phenotype is 2, 2n alleles 1. So if we are here, then we can assume that in every mating, one of the partners is either this foreman species or that foreman species, either all zeros or all ones. So, because these intermediates are so rare that they rarely cross with each other. And then, if we have such a situation when one of your partners is all zeros or all ones, then phenotype is dynamically sufficient. If because the mating is all zeros with some combination of zeros and ones, or all ones with some combination of zeros and ones. And just knowing the total number of, say, ones in this intermediate genotype, that's enough to predict the distribution of phenotypes among the offspring. That's the same version of this the same version of this idea for the diploid case. That's in this case, matings are between diploids, so one of the parents is either all zeros or all ones. Now we have this double vector instead of a single vector, and then you cannot have an individual with which is homozygous with both zeros and both ones. So you cannot have anybody which has 0, 0 at one locus and 1, 1 at some other locus. And again, if you have such a situation, knowing the number of ones in one parent and the number of ones in the other parent is sufficient to predict the distribution of the number of ones and therefore the phenotype distribution among the offspring. So this is one situation when phenotypic modeling is sufficient. And then, this is my model almost 20 years old, and then I made a hypothesis that this final stage of speciation is critical in the sense that it requires the strongest selection. So if natural selection is strong enough to push through the final stage of speciation, it will work from the very beginning. If this were true, then analyzing this final stage is all we need. And I lived happily for 15 years thinking that I solved the problem, although this hypothesis is obviously wrong. And I understood it only, well, several years ago. How do we see that this hypothesis is wrong? At this final stage of speciation, you can immediately see that selection with 50% strength, let's characterize the strength of selection by the depth of this fitness valley. So without loss of generality, fitnesses of these extremes, let's call it 1. And let's assume that fitnesses of all intermediates are 50% minus epsilon. And then this selection is always enough. Because let's assume, so each intermediate mates with some extreme. Let's assume, which is an overestimation, that all offspring are intermediates. So the number of intermediates doubles. And the fourth selection, which is stronger than 50%, will lead to the reduction of the number of intermediates from generation to generation. So this rectangular fitness valley of the depth 50% is enough to push through the final stage of symmetric fixation. But you can very easily see numerically that if you just start the process, if you have a Gaussian distribution and apply a selection of this depth of 50%, you go absolutely nowhere. So my hypothesis was just plain wrong. And still analyzing the final stage of the process is interesting and nice, because not only the number of equations collapses from 2 up to the n's to 2n, but the equations become linear. That's essentially linearization. And because your original system is so highly symmetrical, this linearization leads to the collapse of the variables. And considering this linearization in the neighborhood of equilibrium, which corresponds to speciation, it's interesting. But this equilibrium is not globally attractive. If you want to know when speciation happens, it's not enough to consider only the very last stage of the process. And again, I made this model and proposed this hypothesis in 1983. And for 15 years, there was basically no reaction. Why? I don't know. Well, maybe the whole subject is not interesting. Maybe the model is too difficult. It was published not in Russian, it was published in normal journal, Theoretical Population Biology, and in more or less comprehensible English. And just nobody cares. So that's something interesting. I don't know whether theoretical physics works in the same way. So, yeah. And then the second situation when phenotypical models are working, which is much more general. Let's assume, first of all, without arguing whether this is really the case, let's assume what I call equiprobability of genotypes within a phenotype. So you can have the same phenotype, the same, say, five alleles, one at your all loci, in many different ways. You can have it in loci 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or I'm now programming in C, so it's tempting to start enumerating loci from 0, but I will avoid it. So it's loci 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or it's loci 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, or so on. Let's assume that all these combinations have the same frequencies within the population. If this is the case, the phenotypic model again becomes dynamically sufficient, and this is a hypergeometric model. I first will tell you the history of this model because it's as bizarre as anything else in this business, and then we'll show you how this model, well, actually all the equations are here. So I invented this model in 1984 with two caveats. First of all, my formula was wrong, which is not a big deal. But the worst problem was that I thought that you need this independence of distribution of genotypes not only within a phenotype but globally. And if you have it globally, you have Gaussian distribution. You obviously cannot have any speciation if you have independent distribution of alleles within the whole population. So I thought that you can use this approach only to understand what happens at the very beginning of symmetric speciation. And I have had trouble publishing this even in Russian because referees said that, you know, this is not interesting, it's only the beginning of the process. Finally, I got it published and forget about it completely. Then in 1985, I reviewed a paper by Michael Debley, who proposed this model, which was correct. I mean, he didn't make a mistake. The formula, which I believed was exact, is only asymptotics correct when n tends to infinity. And he has a PhD in algebraic topology, and I have a PhD in zoology, so I don't feel ashamed of this. Anyway, I was really excited. I really thought it's a good model. And I wrote a very positive review. I completely forgot that I did the same 15 years ago. Totally and absolutely. Then I started having kind of second thoughts. You know, that's an ultimate disgrace of a paper, when even the author forgets that the paper. And then 3 years later, I went to Cornell University Library, which had this Russian Genetica from 1984, and I realized that I did something, only Debella did it better. But he did it in the opposite extreme. So I underestimated the scope of applicability of this approach, and he didn't have any thoughts about it. He just assumed that this works everywhere, which is not true. Then another reviewer of Debella's paper was Nick Barton, who also wrote a positive review, forgetting that he also invented this model. It's buried in the appendix to his paper in Evolution, published in 1992, and his mathematics was also correct. It's slight modifications, but it's exactly the same idea, and the idea is fairly trivial. And since the paper is called Phase 3 of Rice Shift and Balance Theory, and since no normal person would ever read anything which has Shift and Balance Theory in its title, I don't believe anybody ever read it. So this model was invented three times and should be correct. And then I wrote a note with a great guy named Max Speck, and we finally made it explicit under what assumptions this model works. So the assumption is equiprobability of genotypes, and we kind of waved our hands to argue that under disruptive selection, this equiprobability is a good approximation at least. And then Max Speck and Nick Barton wrote a big horrible paper with notebooks in Mathematica attached and everything else, in which they apparently proved this, that this equiprobability of genotypes is a really good assumption under disruptive selection. So how this model works? It's the most basic probability theory, the first two chapters of Feller. So we have two parents with phenotypes I and J. Let's assume that they have L loci such that at this L loci they both have alleles 1. Obviously L cannot be larger than minimum of I and J. And this L, let's call it genetic overlap, or one genetic overlap. They overlap the loci where both of them have allele 1. So for such a pair, they are bound to have both have allele 0 at some other loci with total number L plus N minus I minus J, and then they will have different alleles, one 0 and another 1, at the remaining I plus J minus 2L loci. That's an illustration. We have N equal to 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They both have 4 alleles 1, so they both belong to the fourth phenotype, and the genetic overlap is 2. They have both 1s at this 2 loci, and at this locus they have both 0s, and at the remaining 4 loci they have 1, 0 and another 1. So in this case, if we have independent recombination, these loci are unlinked, and Mendelian segregation, this is our operator which we need. The probability that mating of I and J phenotypes with genetic overlap L will produce a phenotype K. This is just a binomial distribution, because here the offspring must have one, here the offspring must have 0, and here it's binomial distribution. And the only thing which This is always true. The only thing which we need to do is to find the distribution of genetic overlap. And this was done by DeBelli and Barton. I screwed it up. Before them, and the assuming equiprobability of genotypes within the phenotype, that's the only place where this assumption is essential. This distribution of overlap for parents I and J is given by this hypergeometric formula. Again, if you don't trust it, I can copy my note with Max Speck in which it is explained, but it's, again, very trivial combinatorics. And then our total operator is just the sum by L of these sub-operators times the distribution of genetic overlap. So this way we get this transition probabilities during reproduction. And then everything else is simple. So that's the whole life cycle. Let's assume that we have reproduction and selection, and reproduction means that they first mate and then they transmit genes. You can have haploids, so you first have syngamy and then meiosis, or you can have diploids, they first have meiosis or syngamy. All can be accommodated within this framework. We have three stepping stones: distribution of phenotypes before reproduction, then after reproduction before selection, and then after selection. And this constitutes the whole generation. So we need a formula which gives you this through this. And having this operator for reproduction, it is trivial. So during reproduction, after reproduction, you will get this as a sum of this thing. And okay, I'm going fast, but I think that physicists are used to equations which are much more simple. This is the probability of mating between I and J. If we have this mass action or random mating situation, this is just a product of their frequencies, but you can assume any pairing rules. And this is a standard selection equation. So you multiply everybody's frequency by its fitness and divide by mean population fitness. So the only problem was to get this transition probability, and again assuming that genotypes are equiprobable within the phenotype, we get it through this hypergeometric formula. Okay, so now...
So here, in this function R, you're assuming sort of a large number of loci.
No. You only assume that all loci are equal. So that's an implicit assumption in every phenotypic model. So my dynamical variable is the frequency of a phenotype, which is frequency of a class of genotypes with a given number of alleles 1. And then I assume that within each class, all possible combinations are equally frequent within the population. That's all the assumptions which are necessary. I think that's a great model and. Well, this is fitness. Between 0 and 1. When I was drawing these figures, this is W of X of K. This is K. Well, yeah, it can be frequency dependent or whatever. This W of K can depend on anything, can depend on my distribution P, or it can be independent. I can do whatever I want. Even these kind of equations are too complicated to be studied just analytically in the general situation, although there are some interesting analytical equations, but they are very good for numerical work. Okay, now what results can be obtained using this model, and I will first show you. That's a typical course. Well, that's actually from a paper which I did using Monte Carlo simulations before I realized how this hypergeometric model can be used to make a deterministic model. So that's an original distribution of phenotypes, and this declining functions with this spread and peaks show you how speciation happens, and it happens in extremely short time. So going from here to here, it takes several hundred generations, which is admittedly a difficult concept for evolutionary biologists to swallow, because I argue that if symmetric speciation happens, it happens very rapidly, because it must be governed by strong selection.
Can I just check whether you've got competition? There's no frequency-dependent selection.
Well, there is some frequency dependence here, but it's frequency dependence is not obvious, because from the very beginning, the distribution here was in the middle. If you start from here, then it will first move you there, and then...
But the fitness is just a function of the phenotype. It's not a function of how many other individuals there are of that phenotype. There's no penalty for being the same as everybody else. That's what I'm saying.
Your fitness is a function only of the phenotype.
Yes, fitness is a function of a phenotype, but this function may depend on the whole distribution of phenotypes. So it's frequency dependent in this sense.
Well, I lost you in that last line. Why is it frequency dependent?
Well, let's go to the very beginning of this Darwinian argument. So, if you are common, your resource is depleted and your fitness is low. So
Is that in the model?
Yes. If it's not in the model, this disruptive selection is very unstable and everything goes either one way or the other way. You don't get the split and everybody becomes very small or everybody becomes very large.
Okay. Can you explain how that goes in? How does it go into the model then? How does the fact that the... In other words, it's those two red lines that have to move, right?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this later, okay? Because there are really two aspects in this business. There is a genetical aspect and an ecological aspect. And I don't want to talk about this frequency dependence for... Okay, let me give you kind of a unfair and formal answer. So in this model, in order to really have speciation instead of everything going this way or that way, we need to make the disruptive selection also frequency dependent. It can be done in various ways. For example, if this distribution shifts To the left a little bit, you give a boost in fitness in fitness to big things and vice versa. It can technically it can be done in many different ways. To do it in an honest way, you need to consider this underlying ecological resources and introduce this some kind of intermediate variables and recalculate this disruptive selection every generation according to what phenotypic distribution they had in the previous generation, which also can be done.
I probably for this question you wanted to go. The fact that you get these two big peaks at the extremes, is it related someplace that I already forgot with the fact that in the end there has to be a mutation which prevents the two peaks from...
That's a good point. Let's give me two more moments. Okay. Now, these are results of Monte Carlo simulations, and these are results of hypergeometric modeling, which essentially coincides with everything. So now I think I need to make my main point. Selection must double the variance. So suppose that we have the initial distribution which corresponds to, well, independent assortment of alleles at different loci, and then you apply some kind of disruptive selection, which is also frequency dependent to some extent, and you see what happens with this distribution. These are numerical results. Again, Monte Carlo and hypergeometric deterministic model give you essentially the same thing. If Monte Carlo population size is larger than 10,000. So this is the height of this bottom of the fitness valley. It's 0.16, so intermediates. So the model selection was this. 10% of the extremes on each side have fitness 1, and the rest have fitness which is indicated here. So, defect in the picture. This means no selection, the bottom of the fitness valley here. This is fitness valley of the depth 50%, 70%, 80%, and so on. The last thing which you can see is the depth 84%, because if the fitness valley is any deeper, then speciation happens. All other curves correspond to equilibrium. So in this case, it has this essentially pentamodal distribution, which is an equilibrium. Population lives in this crazy equilibrium if you have selection which is almost enough but not exactly enough to push through the symmetric speciation. And if selection is even stronger, then population will split and then your point becomes effective. So if we have random mating, then you will have kind of semi-split. You will have big peaks here and big peaks here, but they still keep interbreeding freely, and the four produce a lot of intermediates which are eliminated, so you have some kind of a crazy distribution. So here the assumption was that only two extremes are reproductively isolated. Yeah, I want to make this point should be made clear. There are two options. Yeah, sorry, let's go one step back. That's probably the last significant point which I need to make. Here, there are two possibilities. We can assume that reproductive isolation is due to differences at the same trait, which is under disruptive selection. So, the smallest and the biggest don't interbreed, for example. Here is a less extreme assumption. Here we assume that the probability of interbreeding declines linearly with increase of differences. So in this case, obviously speciation occurs much more easily. So if the depth of the fitness value is 0.29, we have this equilibrium. If the depth is a little bit lower, then we have speciation. So we assumed, so the assumption was that only two opposite extremes are completely isolated, but even between intermediates, there is some reproductive isolation. Here we had the most difficult assumption for speciation, that two extremes are isolated and everybody else interbreed randomly. But still, we assumed here that it's the same trait which is under selection, which may lead to reproductive isolation. That's one assumption. The other assumption, which is probably more biologically reasonable, that's also reasonable. This is Wallace effect. That's a Wallace idea. You first have this disruptive selection, and population may exist like something like this, and then secondary selection favors reproductive isolation between big and small. So this also may happen. I wouldn't discount this possibility of the same traits being responsible for fitness and for mate choice. I wouldn't discount this possibility as something totally crazy. But another option is that you have totally independent traits responsible for selection and responsible for mate choice, which appears to be the case in African cichlids, because whatever natural selection was responsible for producing these thousands of species, it obviously was not on their color. It was on something different. So what could happen if you have this situation? No reproductive isolation at all. Even these extremes can interbreed. But we have another trait, or maybe a pair of other traits which can bring about reproductive isolation. That's what we get. So now we have two or even three quantitative traits, and each is modeled hypergeometrically, and we assume that these traits are inherited independently, so everything is multiplied. So we have two traits, one I call size and another color. Size is responsible for selection, and color is responsible for reproductive isolation. Here we have the simple situation, red mating with red and blue mating with blue. So we have only one reproductively isolating trait. Then this frequency dependent, and we assumed two resources, so it's essentially a Darwinian model. Frequency dependent selection, you see, we start from one corner. Everybody is small and red. Then very rapidly we have variability in size established. After generation 30, we already have this variability in size. But these peaks are not very high because we have a lot of intermediates. We have a lot of intermediates because these things keep interbreeding. They are of the same color, they are not reproductively isolated. Then for quite a while, the generation 30 and this generation 290, it seems that nothing happened. But during this time, we have very slow build-up of variability at this perpendicular trait at color. Originally, they were all red, but then some of them become blue. And then extremely rapidly, one of the species acquires a different color. And then speciation is completed in dozens of generations. Due to this Wallace effect, you want to be different from the other species, because if you are of the same color with the other species, then you produce hybrids which have, not really other species, but other forming species. You produce intermediates which have low fitness. What is funny about this model that this is typical breakage of symmetry. So you can get species which are small and red, so you can, and large and blue. You can have speciation in this direction, or you can have speciation in the perpendicular direction. This depends in a deterministic model on the initial sign of association between these traits, and in the stochastic model it certainly will also depend on chance. But the point is that you have this two-step process. First, establishment of variability in this ecological trait, and then establishment of variability and establishment of non-random association between between the ecological trait and the isolating trait. So that's a two-trait model, and essentially the same thing happens in a three-trait model. So now we have size, we have male color and female preference, and so that's a two-trait isolating mechanism instead of one-trait isolating mechanism, and it works in essentially the same way. I cannot draw three-dimensional surfaces, but if you see what happens, first you have this establishment of variability in ecological trait, and then both isolating traits evolve in order to make two isolated species. Again, this process can go either in this direction or in the perpendicular direction. So now I'm going back to my main claim that in order for all these wonderful things to happen, in the worst case is that you don't have any reproductive isolation, well, at least which affects the beginning of the process. At least these intermediate phenotypes, which are only present initially, they all interbreed randomly. Then you need natural selection, which is strong enough to double the variance. And you can measure how strong selection it requires to double the variance of a Gaussian distribution. It's difficult to prove theorems. Well, first of all, let me not go into this because it's boring, but the point is that you definitely need a pretty strong selection. You need a selection strong in the sense that the depth of this valley, the fitness of intermediates, must be, well, 10 or 20% of fitness of the extremes, but you do not need selection which is catastrophically strong. The total fraction of individuals which survive may be of the order of 50%, maybe 40%. 40% is always sufficient. So you need very strong selection. Then you get a situation which I think can be conveniently called isolation by natural selection. So even here, these opposite extremes, although they freely interbreed, they're effectively isolated because the gene flow from these small individuals to these big small individuals is negligible. All intermediates are under very strong selection. So you have two forming species which are already here, but they keep interbreeding, and then they desperately want to become isolated, and then they will acquire whatever isolating mechanisms are available to them. So my claim is that if symmetric speciation happens, it happens in this way. You first need disruptive frequency dependent selection which is strong enough to double the variance and essentially split the population, and then some form of an isolating mechanism will be acquired. Well, here it was done in a pretty artificial way. So, yeah, so the fitness function was like this. But I also assumed that if some phenotype is very common, then its fitness goes down. So for this population, it's essentially as it was. Well, it's essentially what I made in the first figure again. If the distribution is here, the fitness function is like this. If the distribution is here, the fitness function is like this. And if it's in the middle, the fitness function is like this. So
you just started with this fitness function after some time, you replaced it by the double
helix. Yes. So
how does selection work for the other tree? I mean, there is...
For the other trees, it's all secondary selection. So these things are, directly your fitness doesn't depend on your color at all. But if you are a little bit more blue here, then if you are blue, you will mate with this thing with a higher probability, and the four with a lower probability, your orphan will be intermediate and will be eliminated. And I think that this, so the question is, so for this situation when you have different traits responsible for selection and for reproductive isolation, the key question is whether the equilibrium which corresponds to zero cessation is stable. And if it is unstable, the stability, this symmetry can be broken in either way. So I believe that the stability of this equilibrium can be studied analytically, but it was never done. I don't know. These are all results of deterministic simulations using this hypergeometric model. I really think that there should be a simple way of showing under what conditions the state of zero association between selective trait and isolating traits is unstable.
I would like to compare the situation in which you have two peaks of different sizes but the same color with, let's say, the beta model distribution you had on one of the graphs. Suppose that on that beta model distribution, there is a mutation of the leftmost shoulder, which makes them incompatible with the rightmost shoulder. That already, from an apparent concern, is speciation, and I didn't need to go through this extreme.
Yes. That's a possibility. You can have. Yes, thank you. That's a good point, of course. If you have a much weaker disruptive selection, but then you have the ability to develop reproductive isolation due to differences of the same trait which is under selection, then you can have speciation without this extreme requirement of Dublin's invariance. So my point, I am trying to consider the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario is that disruptive selection and non-random mating are due to completely different traits. And in this case, I believe that you need first all essentially the complete split without reproductive isolation, which requires a doubling of the variance. If you have this other situation, if you can have reproductive isolation due to the same trait, and this can be selected for, which was predicted by Wallace and studied by DeBelli and some other people, then requirements for selection are much less stringent.
So it's probably continuous. And you're just saying that if the initial disruptive selection is not strong enough, then the waiting time becomes much longer. Is that what you're saying? Or?
Well, no, nothing will happen. If selection is not strong enough, nothing will happen. It's not waiting time. There will be no speciation. Well, again, you can assume this selection for perfecting reproductive isolation due to the same trait due to the size, but without this assumption, nothing will happen. It's not a waiting time, unless selection is very strong. So my point is this: you need very strong selection, but you don't need catastrophically strong selection. You don't need to kill 99% of individuals. You have to kill 60% of individuals. If you kill 60% of the extremes, then selection doubles the variance, and even in the worst case, when reproductive isolation and fitness are due to genetically independent traits, symmetric fixation does happen. That's my only point. That's a really, I think it's a really good mathematical problem, and for a smart person, it should be simple to see when this equilibrium correspondent to independence of distribution is these two traits, when it becomes unstable. And when it becomes unstable, you can go this way or that way. Yes?
You assume that your color variable is continuous, so it's, you can move along it. In the case of white and black, all shades of gray. But if you have real colors, red and blue, then probably...
You can be purple. You can be purple.
In order to program it, you need both. Maybe it's more delicate mechanism. Maybe most trivial mechanism is either red or blue. So maybe the most primitive mechanism is discrete colors.
Well, the general situation, it was never proven as a theorem, but I believe it's true. The fewer the number of loss involved, the better for speciation. So if it takes only one locus to become, well, blue instead of red, speciation becomes simple. It requires less stringent assumptions. Again, that's a numerical result, which I don't know whether it's true. It seems that 10 is already close to infinity. So when you have 10 loci responsible for this variability and for that variability, probably it's already pretty close to the asymptotics when the number of loci becomes very large. But it was never proven. But if the number of loci is small, well, that's the better. The problem is that I wanted to talk about data a little bit later. The problem is that we know remarkably little about genetics of interspecies differences. And the standard assumption was that you cannot study interspecies differences in normal crosses because species don't breed. And this is bullshit. Because if you take this Lake Malawi cichlids and put them in your fish tank or even make water muddy, everybody will breed with everybody. And then you need to do genetical analysis or QTL mapping and see how many genes are responsible. People started doing this in the context of allopatric speciation, when you have genetic incompatibility. Here it's kind of ecologically mediated incompatibility, I would say. So if you cross two closely related species, very often hybrids are perfectly happy if you provide them with food and everything. So you need to really, in order to put real numbers, here I assume 16 loci responsible for this and 8 loci responsible for this. In order to put real numbers here, you need to study genetic differences between closely related species of probable sympatric origin. It was never done for any good pair of species. So since I am I'm bent on defending and promoting sympatric speciation, I am always considering the worst case scenarios, which means a large number of loci. If the number of loci is smaller, then the whole thing goes even simpler. Okay. So, yeah, so probably there are only 2 points which I want to make. One point is this, that for some reason, when people talk about sympatric speciation, they assumed this Darwinian disruptive selection, two resources, you either want to be small or you want to be large. And when people talk about allopatric speciation, not genetic revolution, but sane selectionist approach, they talk about this Dobzhansky-Miller epistasis, this curved ridge of high fitness. And I think it's only historical reason, because I think that this model may be more relevant than just disruptive selection acting on one trait. Okay. This is a bad picture because here we have two traits and here we have one trait with high fitness here and here and also frequency dependent. So this is Darwin model, which we discussed repeatedly. And this is the Dobzhansky-Miller model. We can imagine exactly the same situation working sympatrically. So suppose that you have two resources, but our initial assumption was that you want to be small to eat one resource and you want to be large to eat another resource. Now let's assume that in order to eat one resource you want to be large, and in order to eat another resource you want to be, I don't know, black. And then there is a trade-off. If you can do everything, if you can be both large and black, you will eat both resources and then there will be no need for speciation. But if it is, I don't know, too costly to be both large and black, or there are some other trade-offs and constraints which prevents you from going here, then you will have exactly the same Dobzhansky-Miller situation. Perpendicular selection, not disruptive selection, but perpendicular selection and this curved ridge of high fitness. And what I am doing now, I am trying to, well, it's essentially done by 80% already. I'm using the same hypergeometric framework in order to see how symmetric specialization works if we assume two traits in this kind of a fitness function instead of one trait. And it works in a pretty good way, so I'm going to argue that probably we have the same mode of selection underlying both allopatric and symmetric specialization. At least there is no reason to assume that we have one trait disruptive selection and one trait disruptive selection in case of symmetry and something like this in case of allopatric. There is no reason for such a distinction. And finally, let's talk about biology for 3 minutes. What do we know? And we know remarkably little because it seems that if symmetric specialization happens, it happens very rapidly. It's like supernova explosion. You look at the sky, how many supernova do you see every night? You don't see very many. And still, I don't know, 50% of stars go through supernova explosion eventually in their life history or something like this. So if this process is rapid, and I believe that if it happens, it must be rapid because it must be governed by strong selection, then there is a very small chance that you will come to some lake and see something specific and symmetrically. Even if it does happen, it's rapid, but still it's dozens of generations or hundreds of generations. You come into this lake, and how do you know that something is speciating symmetrically? There is a joke which, it's not a joke, it's a real story. I once had to read an instruction for directors of natural reserves in the Soviet Union, I mean for their scientific divisions of natural reserves, and item number 35 or something was this, that in case you observe symmetric specialization happening in your natural reserve, you should notify your supervisors in Moscow immediately. So there will be big... Which was very smart. I think it's a good idea, but I don't know how often it actually happened. So the best evidence for symmetric... Yeah, I'm happy to report that what I am saying now, 10 years ago it sounded like, you know, heresy. Now it becomes a part of an orthodoxy. Well, again, because it's all Darwinian ideas and not much more than that. There will be an issue of the journal Trends in Ecology and Evolution in July, which will be all about speciation, and there will be a lot of stuff on symmetric speciation. And biologists who do not want to appreciate all the theoretical reasoning and the nice features of hypergeometric model, biologists became convinced that symmetric speciation happens by paper by Svante Paabo, Dieter Totz, and some other smart people who found the really irrefutable example. There were two crater lakes in Cameroon, Baron Bembo and another whose name I forgot, and in contrast to huge lakes like Victoria and Malawi, well, Victoria is a big lake, and people always argued that although all these cichlids definitely originated within this lake Victoria, they could go to different corners to speciate and then get together after this painful process is completed. And although it's a complete nonsense, but you cannot really falsify it. So what Totz and Paabo did, they studied crater lakes with diameter less than 1 kilometer, and they found 4 symmetric species of cichlids in one lake and 9 in another lake, and in this case even Meyer and Futuma had to concede that this is an example of symmetric speciation. They had absolutely no room for allopatry. And since these are neat, nice, round crater lakes, they never split into different things, so all this nonsense which people usually proposed as an alternative explanations, so this time it was published in 1994, I believe, and since then symmetric fixation became accepted. I believe that there are forms of fish, genus Carigonus, for example, where in every lake you find symmetric species. And so you find very similar parallel forms, well, let's say deep water and shallow water in different lakes. And when you do phylogeny, there are two options. It could be that shallow water forms from this lake and this lake are related to each other, and deep waters are related this way, but it's never the case. It's always the case that relatedness is like this. So they first colonized different lakes, and then they created parallel ecological forms, which are now species because they don't interbreed, being sympatrically. I think that everybody, regardless of your favorite fitness species concept, everybody would agree that if two sexual things live sympatrically and don't interbreed, they are different species. So you have different species of sympatric origin in these lakes.
How wide is the...
You mean the depth of the lake?
The depth of each of the sections inhabited by a...
Well, it's very different in different cases. It can be meters or tens of meters. These examples are not very well studied, but the rule is that when good ichthyologists come to any Arctic lake, they will find different sympatric forms. And...
To depth.
How do you know?
No, I'm asking.
Nobody knows this. You have to dive there, and the water is very cold. And
you mentioned that.
Well, if you cast a net very deep, you catch one species. Close to the surface, you catch another species. And what they are doing there, well, who knows? It's not hypergeometric model. It's reality. It's extremely difficult to study. So my point is that I believe sympatric fixation is very common in some taxa and probably doesn't happen in other taxa. Some smart person said a long time ago that it's difficult to imagine sympatric fixation in elephants because this niche separation, you know, some elephants eating young and tender leaves and other elephants eating bananas, it's difficult to imagine this. They're so big that for them environment is kind of randomized and generalized. But in fishes, in insects, this may be extremely common, and well, that's probably the whole story. And I think that the message which I wanted to tell is that A, there is some theory in biology, and B, that the theory develops extremely slowly, and if smart people take part in doing this, it could be, well, speed it up by a factor of 10.
You made a very strong case for this Darwin scenario where you first have disruptive selection but still random mating, and afterwards you have a phylogeny developing. I see no logical reason why the opposite scenarios should not also happen, so that you first have some kind of sexual selection, so that the mating being established, and then selection pressure forcing these two daughter species to become ecologically more different.
That's a good point. I completely forget about sympatric fixation. Yes. Sorry. I believe that it doesn't happen because it doesn't work as a model. Sure. Sorry, I cannot find it. Yes. Sorry. So, sympatric fixation by sexual selection, extremely attractive idea. You have this trait of female preference. And these females prefer red, and these females prefer green, and then the whole thing is unstable, and you'll get species consisting of females which prefer red and red males, and females which prefer green and green males. Why I believe that it doesn't happen? It's modeling results. So. Yeah, I can give all the references. There were three papers really published in this. There was an initial paper by Turner and Boras, 1995. Then there was a paper in Nature by Higashi and Takimoto. And then there was a more recent paper in Evolution by Takimoto with some horrible mathematical details. And then there are Mayan published results using the same hypergeometric model. Takimoto also used hypergeometric model without understanding it. Initially, I told him that it's a hypergeometric model when I reviewed his paper. He must be counted as a fourth person who derived this model. So, yeah, I'm writing a paper now which is called Sympatric Speciation by Natural Selection is Impossible. And the reason is this. This scenario with divergent sexual selection, again, these females like in red and these females like in green, this scenario is extremely unstable in the following sense. If your initial population distribution sits right in the center, then everything can work. I observed it in my hypergeometric model. So we again have two traits. We have female preference trait, and then we have a male color trait. Let's assume that they're genetically independent. And then you start here, and well, we have another dimension for male color. So you have some independent distribution here, and then it can split, and you really get two species. And then you need some weak natural selection to stabilize coexistence of these two species, because due to Gauss's principle, they cannot live if they are exactly the same ecologically, but they can be mildly different, so let's assume that this is okay. But the only point which I am making is that if you move your initial distribution a little bit from the center, the whole business collapses, and you go this way, and you don't get split. And the problem is that Turner and Boras assumed only one locus, so this female preference was due to differences at single locus, and then it works. And Higashi and Takimoto did the same. They either started from the center, or they assumed just one or two loci. And in this case, this works. And Fisher's model, which is due to pure Mendelian segregation, also works. My point is that when the number of loci responsible for variability in female preference and in male signal, when this number becomes large, and large means 5, it doesn't mean 100, then this business becomes extremely unstable, and unless God places you exactly in the middle of the range of the distribution initially, you don't speciate, you go either this way or that way. And you can try to stabilize this by assuming stabilizing selection either on female preference or on male color, which was attempted by Turner and Boras. But then you just don't speciate, because stabilizing selection prevents it from speciation. So my opposition to sympatric speciation by sexual selection comes from results of the model and nothing else. The model, I was reviewer of all the papers. I was very enthusiastic. I said it's a great idea. And then when I tried to model it with a large number of loci, which you can do hypergeometrically, then I found that it doesn't work. So
that was finite populations. The reason this one doesn't deterministic, right?
Yes.
But if you have a finite simulation, you're still going both directions by fluctuations, presumably.
Well, no, because the model in which I did was both deterministic and individual based, because the original Turner and Boras paper was individual based Monte Carlo, and the first Higashi Takimoto paper was also individual based, and then they did it deterministically. Usually, if something is unstable, random fluctuations wouldn't stabilize it, so you will only go this way or that way. So, actually, I think that I think that stochasticity makes it only worse.
If you have control genes, you can switch color polymorphism on or off. And what happens? Because that's what happens in reality. You don't have these many genes superposing, but
you
control
gene. Well, if you have one, if you have one gene, so if female is a large, she wants somebody red, and if she is a small, she wants somebody blue, then everything works.
When it's more genetic, it's not.
Yeah, but I believe. Well, okay. If we take two cichlids, one red, another blue, cross them, do genetic analysis of female preference, and find that all the differences are due to one locus, then I would say, okay, it might be that these species originated by sexual selection. But I would be very much surprised if this happens, because when we look at the genetic composition of genetic architecture of any trait, we find a lot of loci.
I mean, if anything you heard on these signaling networks is correct, then it should be very
important. Yeah, but what locus can control. You know, if it's many loci that produce the rights, but one can switch on the expression of this series on
computer. Sure.
Well, you'll find out from only from
microscopic data. That's paper by Seehausen, who uploaded it. Something where one mutation can switch on three different colors.
I don't know. My only point is that what these guys are usually saying, the most popular argument in favor of this sexual selection model is this. If you look at the phylogeny, for example, in Lake Malawi, you'll find that in deep branches of your phylogenetic tree, deep branches of the tree correspond to some easily scored morphological differences. So these are, I don't know, predators, and these are algae feeders, something like this. And then the shallow branches correspond to different colors. So these are red predators, these are blue predators, these are red algae feeders, and these are blue algae feeders. So they say, okay, initially speciation was ecological, but these things are ecologically equivalent, but they only have different colors. I think that this is bad biology, because when you capture a fish and study it just under a dissection microscope, you can have zero idea. Well, you can have some idea. You can discriminate between a predator and algae feeder, but these things can use totally different ecological niches. They can eat their algae in different times of the day. They can do whatever hell they want to do. So this is, for me, this is not an argument at all. And another argument is that these things are of different colors, so sexual selection must have been involved. That's also wrong. Different colors is certainly an isolated mechanism, but whether it was active process like sexual selection, or it was a secondary way of getting isolated under disrupted selection, we don't know. And as far as modeling results are concerned, my impression is that it shows that this process is unstable and doesn't work.
How do you do the choice of mates in that model?
There are two models. The Turner and Burrows assumed best of N rule. So female, which is here, she, I don't know, looks for N males and takes the reddest one, and this takes the greenest one. What do you do with intermediate females? It's hard to say, because Turner and Burrows assumed one locus with complete dominance. And I am sorry, but I am a geneticist. This is not a common situation when two species are different by a single locus with a complete dominance. Forget about it.
Even when N, the number of choices of males to pick from is large.
Yes.
You still, with the black case, you still go along.
Yes. Yeah, because they keep interbreeding here. They will be isolated only when they split, and this doesn't happen. Again, this is a technical result which might be wrong, but as far as my modeling is concerned, I don't get symmetric fixation by sexual selection with a large number of loci due to this instability.
Okay, so I guess there will be some discussion this afternoon following Martin Rossport and a really related subject for the space of difference in the station. So let's thank you.
Okay.